This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, May 22, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, NATO's plan for Afghanistan comes under scrutiny as more than a decade of war continues. In Alabama, human rights advocates call for an investigation into a women's prison after numerous accounts of sexual violence and a culture of impunity comes to light. And we'll go to Egypt, where voices from digital media are shaping the debate ahead of tomorrow's presidential election. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in Headlines. In Syria, members of the United Nations Observer Mission were in Deir al-Zor today. According to a spokesperson for the Free Syrian Army, government troops fired on civilians who rushed out to greet the UN team. Two people reportedly died. A spokesperson for the UN observers says they did hear gunfire but did not see any casualties. In Damascus today, at least five people died in an explosion. The head of the UN's Department of Peacekeeping, Hervé Ladsou, spoke in Damascus.
There is a third element, or there are third elements, and these people are not committed to the cause of the Syrian people. They are committed to their own agenda.
Yesterday, an al-Qaeda-affiliated group known as the Al-Nusra, or Salvation Front, claimed responsibility for a weekend attack in which at least nine people died. And Syrian-influenced tension across the border grew today when more than a dozen Shiite pilgrims were abducted in Aleppo province as they returned to Lebanon from a religious trip to Iraq. Weekend unrest escalated when two clerics were killed Sunday. Syrians fleeing the violence in their country have streamed into Lebanon, where violence in Tripoli was triggered more than a week ago when authorities arrested Sunni activist Chadi Malawi. He was released on bail today. In Mali, the transitional president remains in power today following an attack yesterday, and ECOWAS threatens more sanctions. Amadou Timbene reports.
Thousands of supporters of the military junta protested an agreement struck over the weekend that extends the transitional civilian leadership of the country. Protesters stormed the presidential palace and assaulted the transitional president Jonkunda Traore, demanding he steps down. Traore was treated and released from a local hospital. Prime Minister Sheikh Modibo Diarra said that he fears chaos if violence continues.
I'm asking young people not to protest again. I understand their grievances and will make sure that they are transmitted to the right people.
The protest followed the announcement on Sunday by the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, that extended the mandate of the country's current president. The agreement with the junta leader, Captain Amadou Sanogo, recognizes him as a former head of state with all the benefits. This move angered many people in the capital who say it is up to the people of Mali to choose their leaders. Amadou Timbine, FSR in Bamako.
Europe's food agency has rejected a French ban on genetically modified corn made by the U.S. firm Monsanto. The body has ruled that there is no proof that GMO crops are harmful to human health or the environment. FSRN's Clea Calcutt reports from France.
The European Union is considering calling on France to lift its ban on genetically modified crops. On Monday, Europe's Food and Safety Agency, the EFSA, ruled France had failed to prove GMO crops were harmful. In 2008, France sided with environmentalists in banning a strain of insect-resistant corn marketed by U.S. firm Monsanto, citing public safety concerns. That ban was overturned by the country's top court in 2011. Then this spring, another ban was ordered, this time to protect the environment. Now the European Union is rejecting the ban. However, EU officials are not expected to press France on lifting the ban until the new president, François Hollande, clarifies his position on GMO crops. Clea Calcutt, FSRN, Paris.
New Jersey prosecutors say they plan to appeal a 30-day sentence handed down yesterday against a former Rutgers University student found guilty of a hate crime against his gay roommate, who later killed himself. Darren Ravi set up a webcam to spy on Tyler Clementi during an intimate encounter. He then used social media to describe what he saw. Despite noting from the bench that the invasion of privacy and bias in the case were both, quote, colossally insensitive and criminal, Judge Glenn Berman gave Ravi just 30 days, 3 years probation, and a $10,000 fine. Ravi was convicted in March of invasion of privacy and a hate crime, bias intimidation on the basis of sexual orientation. But as Judge Berman explains, it was the charges related to covering up his actions that elicited the jail time.
Now, allowing you to simply return home without any custodial component to this sentence would be sorely misinterpreted by you and others as a license to contaminate the judicial process with impunity.
For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. NATO concluded its summit in Chicago with a lengthy declaration by the member countries on issues ranging from which new countries could soon join the alliance to statements against nuclear proliferation and sexual violence. Front and center at the meeting, which wrapped up Monday night, was the future of an international military presence in Afghanistan as the coalition begins to plan for the day when Afghanistan will both staff and fund its own military and police. But critics say NATO shouldn't sacrifice more dollars and lives to a failing mission. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
As protesters continued to march and clash with police on the streets of Chicago on Monday, President Obama gave an update on the war in Afghanistan, saying 33,000 U.S. troops will come home by the end of the summer, and Afghan forces will take the lead in combat operations by the middle of next year.
We also agreed on what NATO's relationship with Afghanistan will look like after 2014. NATO will continue to train, advise, and assist and support Afghan forces as they grow stronger.
Earlier this month, Afghan President Hamid Karzai announced that 75% of the country's population will soon be living in areas where Afghan troops have taken over security. But some national security analysts argue the country's military and police aren't yet up to the job. At Monday's press conference, President Obama responded to criticisms that 2014 is too soon to end NATO's combat role.
No matter how much good we're doing and how outstanding our troops and our civilians and diplomats are doing on the ground, 10 years in a country that's very different, that's a strain, not only on our folks, but also that country, which at a point is going to be very sensitive about its own sovereignty.
Yet, President Obama signed a strategic partnership agreement with Afghanistan a few weeks ago that lays the ground for at least another decade of U.S. soldiers, diplomats, and private contractors in the country. And on Monday, NATO released a resolution calling for the immediate creation of a new non-combat mission in Afghanistan, focusing on training and assistance, and the continued funding of the Afghan military at a cost of about $4 billion per year. NATO will expect Afghanistan to cover these expenses itself by 2024, depending on its economic recovery. While some say the proposed schedule is too hasty, others say it's not quick enough. France's newly elected president, François Hollande, says he will withdraw all French combat troops from Afghanistan by the end of this year, and New Zealand announced Tuesday it will bring its soldiers home in 2013, a year ahead of schedule. Some members of the U.S. Congress have also called for accelerated withdrawal. Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich criticized NATO for framing Monday's agreement as an end to the war, saying, quote, "These talks are simply about financing the next phase of the war." Kucinich is co-sponsoring a bill by California Democrat Barbara Lee to only fund the withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan and defund all other aspects of the war.
I will support any politician who will move forward and try to bring this thing to a screeching halt.
That's Afghanistan veteran Jacob David George. He says his experience in combat inspired him to work for the passage of Barbara Lee's bill and other anti-war measures.
We have effectively lost the war in Afghanistan, and the sooner we get out of there, the better. There's going to be violence, but there's also going to be resolve, and that resolve isn't going to come until we remove ourselves from the equation.
George served three tours in Afghanistan between 2001 and 2004 and was one of several veterans to return his service medals this weekend at the Chicago protests against NATO. The oldest son of a chicken farming family in Arkansas, he described the moment he first began to question the morality and effectiveness of the war.
First time I went out to the Pakistan border, we landed in a farmer's field and I ran off a helicopter, and this farmer looked at me like I was a demon or something, you know, of course, because I'm heavily armed, I'm covered in weapons and ammo and stuff, and you know, he's has every right to look at me like that. And I knew that fear in his eyes, because if I saw someone land on my grandpa's farm and run off with a weapon, I would be pretty upset too, and I would probably pick up a gun and fight back. And one of the things that really struck me while I was over there is that we have hillbilly farmers flying halfway around the world to fight and kill hillbilly farmers while the people of our nation starve.
NATO's announcements included plans to boost its surveillance capabilities with 5 new Global Hawk drones. The nation's also committed to funding anti-piracy missions off the coast of Somalia and an air policing mission in the Baltic states, among other military efforts. They also encouraged the efforts of Montenegro, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Georgia, and Macedonia to join the NATO alliance. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Today, a legal advocacy group filed a complaint with the Department of Justice calling for an investigation into widespread sexual assault and harassment at Alabama's only prison for women. According to the Equal Justice Initiative, who filed the complaint, inmates describe frequent and severe officer-on-inmate sexual violence. Several prisoners became pregnant after being raped by correction officers, according to findings in the complaint, and authorities punished female inmates who attempted to bring incidents to light. For more, we're joined by Brian Stevenson, director of the Equal Justice Initiative. He joins us from Montgomery. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
In the complaint, you call the sexual violence at the Tutwiler Prison for Women in Alabama frequent and severe. What did you find in interviewing women at the prison?
Well, we interviewed over 50 people who reported being the victims of sexual violence or being witnesses to sexual violence in the last few years. We were concerned about that, and so we did some further digging and found that there were a number of officers and staff who had been terminated and even criminally prosecuted for sexual misconduct. We were alarmed that the way that these people were being prosecuted was not very severe. That is, instead of being charged with rape, if that was the allegation, they were being charged with a misdemeanor or Class C felony. And one of the things that prompted us to act is that most of these folks were not being given any serious punishment. 6 people have been prosecuted in the last 2 years, only one of whom served more than 5 days in jail, despite some pretty horrifying allegations. One of the women we met alleged that she was raped by an officer. She got pregnant, and then DNA confirmed that this officer was the father of this child, and that man was only sentenced to 6 months in prison. He's since been released on probation, and we think that's created an environment where officers and staff believe that they can victimize women with impunity.
And talk also about the response from authorities, not just when incidents like this come to light and it goes through a judicial process, but when there are complaints from inmates about the kind of environment you're describing. What has been the response?
Well, again, I think that most women who have made these kinds of complaints have been told that it's their fault, that they're just trying to get the officers in trouble. They are frequently placed in segregation. They lose privileges. They are treated as if they have done something wrong, which is a real disincentive for women to come forward and actually make allegations of abuse. I mean, a lot of these things are not actually instances where it's one person's word against another. There are frequently witnesses. There's often biological evidence. And so the prison really doesn't need to respond in the way that we believe they've responded in too many of these cases. You know, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, which Congress passed in 2003, calls for zero tolerance of sexual violence and rape in prisons. We're not going to achieve that if we don't make it safe for people who have been the victims of sexual violence to come forward and make a complaint.
And talk more also about the day-to-day environment that's created by this, even in something as simple as bathing, washing, changing the violations of privacy that some of the witnesses and some of the people you interviewed described.
Yeah, I think that one of the real tragedies is that when you see widespread violence and victimization, you feel at risk, you feel vulnerable, and it makes even simple and ordinary acts much more worrisome, much more fearful. Male staff do come into the showers. They do inappropriately comment on the women and harass the women while they're vulnerable and exposed. They come into the bathrooms. They do things that undermine the ability of women to feel like they are safe. There are lots of women guards that could play this role without some of these problems. And so that's a policy that we think is contributing to the difficulties that we found in our investigation.
And what exactly are you calling on the Department of Justice, the federal agency, to look into for the Alabama State Department of Corrections?
Well, as a nonprofit, our authority is limited. We don't have the ability to talk to anyone and everyone at the prison. We don't have prosecutorial authority. We think that some of what we've learned does suggest that there could be criminal violations that need to be pursued and certainly civil violations that need to be pursued, and we're asking the Department of Justice to take that up. They are empowered by Congress to implement the Prison Rape Elimination Act, to enforce the guidelines and directives that have made eliminating horrific sexual violence a priority. And we're hoping that under that mandate, they will look at Tutwiler and take immediate action to deal with what are some pretty serious problems.
Brian Stevenson is director of the Equal Justice Initiative. His organization is calling for a federal investigation into allegations of widespread sexual violence at Alabama's prison for women. Brian Stevenson, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
We continue our look at sexual violence by examining crimes in the agricultural industry. According to a new report by Human Rights Watch, immigrant women and girls face rape, stalking, unwanted touching, exhibitionism, and vulgar language by supervisors, employers, and others in positions of power. The report, based on 160 interviews and survivors, underscores legislation currently in Congress to protect workers from abuse. FSRN's Vic Bedoyan reports from Fresno.
Grace Meng traveled throughout California and other states interviewing farm workers. What she found was a chilling scenario of abuse and intimidation.
I interviewed a woman who said that she had been raped by a supervisor. And she said afterward, he said to her very explicitly, "You need to remember that it's because of me that you have this job," and continued to threaten her so that she would be intimidated from reporting the abuse.
Meng, author of the Human Rights Watch report, said she met many women who are trapped between two stark realities, sexual harassment and losing their jobs and being deported.
The stories followed a very common pattern where a supervisor or foreman or someone who's in a position of power was able to take advantage of their power.
Advocates are calling on lawmakers in Congress to pass the Senate version of the Violence Against Women Act, which includes some protections for immigrant victims of violence. But some say more should be done to stop these crimes, and employers need to take action now. Felicia Espinoza is an attorney in the Fresno office of California Rural Legal Assistance.
They're the ones that hopefully will start doing more trainings that will follow up with their foreman, make sure that the foreman is reporting what they're doing, have more supervision of our workers themselves, do actual trainings for sexual harassment. If there is an actual complaint, investigate the complaint.
In addition to abuse of immigrant workers in the agriculture sector, human rights advocates are also concerned about instances of sexual abuse against LGBT farm workers. Vic Bedoyan, FSRN, Fresno.
Tune in this Monday, May 28th, for an exclusive documentary from FSRN.
We are not your experimental test subjects. We are the essence. We are not bound by instinctive nature.
As federal and state officials push controversial programs to reform the education system, communities are fighting back. Students, parents, and teachers are demanding respect and a say in how their schools are run.
We are a fast and ever-evolving people of innovative and revolutionary minds. We are humans, and I think it's time you start treating us as such.
Neighborhood Schools, the fight for the future of American public education. That's this Monday, Memorial Day, on your local station and at fsrn.org. Last night, the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, passed a law that allows tax deductions for people who donate money for settlements. The new law comes as settler attacks on West Bank Palestinians have increased. FSRN's Ghassan Banora has more.
The new law will give a 35% tax deduction to donors that give to nonprofits that encourage settlement construction, including in the West Bank. The bill, which passed 33-13, was submitted by head of the ruling government coalition, Zev Elkin, who is also a settler himself. Many Palestinians say the law is another move by the Israeli government to build more settlements in the West Bank. Ghassan Douglas is head of the Palestinian Authority Settlements Watch Unit in northern West Bank.
Every day we document an attack by settlers and the Israeli occupation army, burning of trees, smashing cars of Palestinians. It's clear that the Israeli government is a settlers' government. Since the start of this year, there have been 17 decisions by this government, either to take over lands or build more settlements. This law makes it clear that this government supports settlements.
The new Israeli law comes after an increase in attacks by settlers targeting Palestinians in the West Bank. In a violent attack on Saturday, Israeli settlers, some of them armed, stormed Asira al-Qibliya village in northern West Bank. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem filmed the attack. Several settlers began shooting at the Palestinian residents. Palestinian youth responded by throwing stones. One 24-year-old was shot in the head. Ahmed Jaber was also injured on Saturday. He talked to Afasaran from his hospital bed in Nablus city.
Settlers stormed our village and started to burn our olive trees and other crops. Village youth rushed to stop them. They opened fire at us and also shot tear gas at us, as well as throwing stones. I got hit in my face with a stone by the settlers.
B'Tselem questions why border police and soldiers who arrived on the scene did not try to stop the attack. The organization and Palestinian activists say this isn't the first time Israeli troops have failed to intervene to stop the violence. In total, there are around 500,000 settlers living in West Bank settlements, including those in East Jerusalem. According to international law, all of those settlements are illegal. Ghassan Banoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
As Egyptians prepare to vote in presidential elections tomorrow, many are evaluating the uprising that led to the ouster of Hosni Mubarak. During that period, citizen journalists and community media played a key role in challenging authority, while digital media offered new ways to express views. Some of those alternative voices came from online radio stations, which have been working for years to create an informed and active population. From Cairo, Simba Rousseau has more.
The 18-day revolt that toppled former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak was organized by groups who creatively use social media and internet radio. Armed with digital audio recorders and mobile phones, people communicated information about protest routes and police brutality. Live reports from Tahrir Square offered an alternative voice to the propaganda spread by state television. The Egyptian Democratic Academy, a youth NGO aimed at fostering a culture of political participation, established its online community-run station El Marosa in 2009. The station uses community reporting to disseminate views on freedom of speech, democracy, tolerance, and human rights. Their media trainings focus on marginalized groups such as women, children, and people with disabilities. Yusuf Mohammed is the campaign and activities coordinator.
At the moment, we have three programs. One about the new media that focuses on video advocacy. We offer workshops to young people and bloggers on how to create their own radio and television channels, as well as newspapers, by showing them how to take photos and video. The Political Academy is a program about democracy, where we teach youth how to vote, their rights as citizens, how to be a politician, or how to form a political party. Another project that we initiated called Free Egyptian offers training to women on how to participate in the political life. Recently, we had a training about women in the parliament, and soon we'll have another training for activists interested in being staffers with current MPs.
A group of young journalists created Egypt's first internet radio station in 2007. With years of experience behind it, Radio Horitna offers an array of workshops on tolerance between Christians and Muslims, how to vote, and the importance of maintaining freedom of speech. Radio Horitna's editor-in-chief, Mustafa Fathi, says radio is an important means of fostering community participation.
It's hard to go to, for example, Al Masr Al Youm or Al Ahram and give them your article to publish. It is very hard here in Egypt. But Hurriyetna is open for anyone. If you have an idea, come. We will publish your article in our website. Or if you have idea for a program, we will broadcast your program live in our radio station.
One station, Banat Wabas, or Girls Only, became the region's first online radio station catering to the issues of Arab women. First established in April 2008, it now has a fan base of nearly 5 million listeners throughout the Arab world. Amani El Tunzi is the founder.
I preferred to be my message is empowering women, because we're suffering in Egypt from a lot of things as a women and girls too, like harassment, violence, and gender equality.
Last year, watchdog group Reporters Sans Frontières moved Egypt from its internet enemies list to countries under surveillance due to the success of the country's uprisings. Again, Yusuf Mohammed.
Before and after the revolution, activists, bloggers, and radio stations were being monitored. The military council has investigated us, as well as our colleague Esra Abdel Fattah. But we moved forward, and we're not going back again. We gained our freedom, and we paid a very expensive price. And we're not going to give this away, even if we were detained, because we learned a lesson from this revolution. Many Egyptians lost their lives, their eyes, and we are using our voices for Egypt. This means that we'll do more, and we are ready to pay more if it means freedom.
Egyptians are preparing to vote in the country's first post-Mubarak presidential elections. However, with the recent crackdown by the Supreme Council of Armed Forces on several satellite channels, many say more reforms are needed, including amended media laws once the transition from military control is complete. For Free Speech Radio News, reporting from Cairo, I'm Simba Russo.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Eder and Zane Carisley. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.